This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Monty Wente-Reme. I played Icheb on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Metatrex on Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 61 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be picking up the second part of a two-part discussion with author Duncan Barrett, in which we discuss our top picks for essential Trek philosophy from Season 6 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We don't often do two-part discussions here on Metatrex, because we like to try to pack everything irrelevant to a discussion into one episode, but we had such a good but lengthy discussion with Duncan last week that we decided we'd split this episode into two.
Yeah, Zachary, it was great to welcome Duncan back to the Starship of Theseus and to get him here on Metatrex to be a part of this conversation. And as we were going along, we noticed that we were taking our time and really discussing in depth. This really was, as we've mentioned, a deep dive. And we didn't want to cut it. We really wanted our listeners to have the benefit of hearing all of these perspectives and insights. So we decided to make this a two-parter, and we're glad to have Duncan back with us. So we're going to dive back into the conversation and kind of pick up where we left off and finish out our Season 6 Deep Space Nine Essential Trek Philosophy lists. So guys, by my count, we each have covered two picks, or at least we've had a couple crossovers. So Rocks and Shoals was on both Duncan and Zachary's list. In the Pale Moonlight was on both Zachary's and my list. Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night was on my list. Duncan, that was one of your honorable mentions. Statistical Probability was Duncan's pick and is one of my honorable mentions. So Zachary, that brings us to your final Essential Trek Philosophy Deep Space Nine Season 6.
Okay, so for my final pick, I went a completely different direction than anything we've been talking about so far. I decided to include Prophet and Lace.
Yeah.
and
well, it was worth me watching it then, I suppose.
And it's not for the deepest of reasons. I think a lot of the times the Ferengi in Deep Space Nine are misused and misunderstood. Like, I think the comedic aspect of the Ferengi really bothers some people. They don't like the way the Ferengi are portrayed. They don't get the humor. They don't like it. Here, I think the humor of the Ferengi does an absolute service towards making a point. It's not a very deep point, which is just that gender equality and sexual equality is an important thing to take into account. So we get to see the inequality in Ferengi society brought to light through Ferengi humor, through the absurdity of the Ferengi behavior in this episode. And this is, I think, it's just a brilliant use of using humor to reveal something about Ferengi society that it's analogous to our own society. You know, we laugh at the absurdity of gender inequality in Ferengi society and all the comic hijinks that ensue in this episode. But really, we're laughing at ourselves. You know, it reveals what's absurd about gender inequality in our own world. And I think that's how the Ferengi should be used in this episode. These Ferengi are ourselves, and when we're laughing at them, we're really laughing at the absurdity in our own society. So it's not a very deep point. It's just that, you know, gender equality is a good thing. You know, when we see a society that's unjust, you know, we want to draw attention to it. And this episode brilliantly uses the comedic nature of the Ferengi to reveal something about our own society that we don't like, that we wish wasn't the case.
I would say, Zachary, I agree with you about maybe the first 10 minutes of this episode. I think I think basically until we get to the lace, all the stuff about the prophet, I don't mind. I don't have a problem with that. And I think the thing is, yes, there is this kind of basic idea that gender equality will be better. And there are kind of, you know, sort of mercenary reasons given for that. The arguments given, as ridiculous as they may be, about, you know, women should wear clothes so they have pockets so that they can earn Latinum and so on. But the problem for me, aside from the fact that I don't find it very funny, is that I feel that after that first 10 minutes, once you get into the drag stuff, I just think the drag stuff is awful. And I do think that, you know, probably unintentionally, it's quite... maybe it's a bit harsh to say it's misogynistic, but it encodes so many sort of very unhelpful ideas about what femininity is. There's a kind of slightly, the kind of camp around it is slightly problematic. You know, from a modern perspective, a lot of people would say it's a very transphobic episode. I mean, I don't mind slightly letting them off the hook for that, given the time frame. But I think the representation, and it's not entirely Armin Shimerman's fault that his version of a woman is so ridiculous and so sexist and so absurd. And I know it's meant to be absurd and it's meant to be ridiculous, but at the same time, the episode does really sort of reinforce, I think, a lot of ideas about women being irrational, being emotional. You know, he becomes this sort of hysterical camp figure, in a sense, who's weeping the whole time, who can't cope with anything, who's, you know, it's a really... there's something quite unpleasant about it for me. I find it uncomfortable watching it, as well as not being very funny.
I'm glad you say this, because I think Star Trek in general suffers from this, that as progressive as Star Trek can be in whatever time period it's in, it also suffers from being... it suffers from the constraints of its time period as well. We see this in the 1960s with the original series. It's progressive in some ways, and it's not very progressive in other ways. Into the 90s, I think you can see a tendency towards gender equality. You know, we're coming out of the second wave feminist movement, so we've got some trajectory towards gender equality. We see this in Star Trek Voyager with Captain Janeway as captain. But... you know, it's not like that narrative is finished yet. It's, you know, that it's still very much a product of the 90s. I think when we look at these shows, you know, here 20 some odd years later, you know, we're 20 more years into that progressive trajectory than they were in the 90s. So it's hard, because you want to kind of fault them and say, look, this is ridiculous. They're encoding so many biases into this portrayal. But that's always true. That was true in the 60s. That's true in the 90s. It's going to be true of whatever series, in whatever Star Trek Discovery is going to be like. Yeah, but I think what you can see is an overall trajectory towards progressiveness and towards equality. Even though at any moment in that trajectory from the 60s into the 90s, there are assumptions and biases that are encoded into the humor and into the portrayals that what I'm not saying is that we shouldn't fault them for that. I mean, you know, we do want to look at it through our lenses and say, look, you know, from our perspective 20 years later, there are some things that are problematic in this episode. Mm-hmm. We do want to shed light on those, but we also can't fault people for being a product of their time period either. So we don't want to give them a pass for it, but we don't want to not draw attention to it.
Maybe it's harder when it's our time period as well, though. You see, I think that's the thing. If I watch the original series, you know, I wasn't alive when that show was broadcast. I can see it more as a historical document. I think maybe it is partly, I mean, I remember these episodes. I don't remember what my attitude to this episode was, you know, 20 odd years ago or whatever. But the fact that it's from my own lifetime makes it harder to grant a pass in that way for me. And I just think there are, you know, even, I think, you know, on the positive front, the writers of Deep Space Nine wrote fantastic female characters, you know, arguably like Dax and Kira are, I mean, you know, many people say Kira is probably the best female character in Star Trek, better than Janeway, better than anyone in Voyager, possibly. They were very good at writing strong female characters. But I think when it comes to humour and kind of, like you say, sort of feminist issues, they had a bit of a blind spot on occasion. I mean, I'm just thinking, even say this little storyline that brackets this episode about this Darbo girl who Quark wants to perform sexual favors and is basically, as her employer, essentially kind of threatening and bullying her into performing sexual favors. And and that's treated as a joke, and it's kind of, you know, it's being milked for comedy. And then the ridiculous idea at the end that actually she's disappointed when he says he doesn't want her to anymore, and that she really fancies the idea of performing sexual favours on Quark. It's like it's sort of trying to neutralise that issue with a joke, but it's at the same time that's a kind of, it's a sort of grotesque wish fulfillment, this idea. And it's totally implausible that this woman has, that's really what she thinks. But the show, by telling us that, is sort of forcing us to accept this ludicrous statement that it's making about this character. I mean, it's a small thing, you know, I don't want to, you know, make a massive issue about it. But I think this episode is, there are reasons why it's problematic, in the same way as, say, Turnabout Intruder is problematic to watch for TOS. And again, to me, you know, neither of them is a very good episode, even if you can look past the sort of political side of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the writers for this episode probably had some sort of like 1970s lowbrow comedy in mind. Like, you know, a guy in a dress will always be funny. Mm-hmm. So let's do that and get a laugh. And, you know, it's like something like Bosom Buddies, Tom Hanks in a dress, right? Okay, that's always funny. Mm-hmm. So I get that. I think there's something to this idea that the subject matter itself doesn't have to be highbrow and make the deepest point. What it needs to do is draw attention to something. Mm-hmm. The fact that we're talking about it 20 mm-hmm. years later can speak to its effectiveness from a social change standpoint, whether or not the things that were portrayed in the episode are of high character or not. So, you know, I don't know. Does that make sense? Like, I just feel like,
I mean, I tell you what, I think
it raises the issue in a way that that it didn't. Other portrayals of gender inside Star Trek in general and inside many other shows at the time wouldn't have even raised the issue. And Star Trek is at least raising the issue. Yeah, yes, they're going for some lowbrow humor, but they are drawing attention to a genuine problem that we're talking about 20 years after the fact. So it's effective from a social change standpoint.
Mm. Well, I think, I mean, Deep Space Nine in particular, you know, you might say, in kind of modern terms, there is an element of gender fluidity in that series. If you look at the character of Dax, for example, mm-hmm. that's quite an interesting character who has male and female aspects and, you know, sort of stereotypically male and female aspects, and how that plays in and what does it mean to be gendered or to be genderless. I mean, I think even in Prophet and Lace, actually, Rom is quite an interesting character because Rom demonstrates, I suppose, what you might call a sort of gender fluidity in a way that I don't think is sort of uncomfortable or offensive or whatever. It is genuinely funny, the fact that Rom has this a sort of access to this sort of feminine side, to these kind of repertoires of femininity in this way. It's a really nice scene, that aspect of it. I think it's just the stuff with Quark, it's so broad, and it feels so, like you say, like a sort of 1970s comedy or something. I suppose that's what it feels. I mean, I know we're looking at 20 years later, but it feels dated even by its own standards, you know, and I guess that's what they're going for, but I think it was a mistake for them to do it that way.
I think any,
you know, maybe there was another way they could have done this episode, but
I think a lot of social and political movements don't have a solution necessarily in mind. The goal is to expose something, to draw attention to it, to raise the signs and go, look at the injustice that's going on. Even if you don't have a final solution, the first task is to draw attention to it.
But this is just laughing at a guy in drag, isn't it? Essentially, I mean, I don't see this episode as.
I latched on to the first 10 minutes of the episode and didn't worry so much about the guy in drag aspect.
And I really like that scene as well. There's a really well directed scene in there where they're all. It's like the sort of call center scene, you know, where they're all contacting all these Ferengi and trying to get them to come. I think there are nice moments within that episode, but for me, just as soon as Quark, you know, goes under the knife,
is not essential Trek philosophy.
Something seriously goes wrong. Not for me, no. But you know, each to his own.
I'm frankly shocked that this was on any list. Zachary, our listeners could not see my expression when you threw that out there for the first time. Since we began Metatrex, my jaw dropped. I could not believe this was on your list.
But I still think this is one of the most brilliant use of the Ferengi in general in Star Trek, and an often misunderstood portrayal.
I would just like to forget this episode, but.
Well, now you have to go rewatch it. So, yeah. with fresh eyes.
Yeah, you're gonna have to do a whole episode just on Profit and Lace now.
That sounds like a challenge to me.
What a commentary, yeah. Meditrex commentary.
I do have a more serious honorable mention, which I could mention now or mention later.
Well, I've got one more pick. I know, Duncan, you have one more, and then we'll lightning round whatever honorable mentions are left. So what is on my list that I honestly thought this was going to be on everyone's list, Far Beyond the Stars, one of the best episodes of Star Trek ever, and just beyond fascinating in that it delves into the nature of reality. There's this whole aspect of, you know, what is the dream? Who is the dreamer? It's really fascinating. And at the end of the episode, you're kind of left with this question. And I really enjoy episodes of Star Trek where at the end of the episode, you truly have more questions than you have answers. You really aren't given at the end of this episode the answer to the question, you know, who's the dream and who's the dreamer? And so I won't go into a great commentary about this episode. There's a lot of interesting things inside of it. We talked about inequality of the sexes, Kira's character in the, we'll call it the alternate universe where she is a science fiction writer. You know, she has to go by her initials rather than her name because, my goodness, you know, during this time period, we couldn't let anyone know that there was a female science fiction writer. It was a nod and homage to D.C. Fontana, Dorothy Fontana. In the episode, there is the kind of racial equality issues with Avery Brooks's character, Benjamin Sisko's character, Brother Benny, being a black science fiction writer and not accepting what he's written at face value among other reasons, the fact that he is a black man. And so you see these struggles inside the episode. It's a great juxtaposition between the somewhat optimistic future of Star Trek and kind of looking back and juxtaposing that to, you know, where we came from in the 1950s and 1960s and the world that was. So Far Beyond the Stars, my number one, it's honestly my number one pick for Essential Trek Philosophy DS9 Season 6.
So this was my honorable mention that I just referred to, and for very much the same reason. I think I'm fascinated by the Cartesian skepticism issues that are raised. How do you distinguish between dream and reality? Is there some characteristic difference between the two that allows you to really settle the question, how do you know that it's not a dream? I mean, we've all had that experience, I think, of going, this is such a weird reality that how do I know I'm not in someone else's dream or a character in someone else's fiction? Sometimes reality has that kind of, you know, quasi-fictional character to it. So I like the Cartesian aspect. I think this episode does a great job of revealing how far we've come since the time period that's depicted inside the alternate reality and how far we still have to go. I mean, the juxtaposition of the portrayal of the 50s with gender and racial issues at play in this episode, contrasted with what we see in the 24th century inside Star Trek versus where we are here in the 2010s, you know, you can see a progression. So this episode just does a great job of revealing the fact that humanity's made a lot of progress on a lot of these fronts, but we're not there yet. We have a long way to go from getting from there to here, to use the line from Star Trek Enterprise, you know, into the 24th century. So again, it's similar to the reason I included Prophet and Lace. I think, you know, in Season 6 of Deep Space Nine, we are exposing gender and racial issues that are still problems in the real world. But I think they're making the claim that, look, we have made a lot of progress. You know, we're not there yet. There's a lot of work yet to be done. We're not in the 24th century, but we're not in the 1950s either by the time this episode airs.
I think this is, I mean, this obviously is a wonderful episode, probably, and it's always a toss up between this one and In the Pale Moonlight, for which is the best DS9 episode. And I personally think this is a better, I mean, I love them both, but I think this is the better 45 minutes of TV. I think it's a wonderful episode. I didn't actually make it on my list, largely because I felt fairly confident that one of you would, but also because I find this episode mysterious. I love it as a drama. And I think there are things that you can say about it, but I don't entirely feel... I feel it asks a lot more questions than it answers in some way, and a lot of it is slightly sort of opaque. I mean, I sort of read it on certainly on one level as kind of a kind of meta commentary on Star Trek, in a sense. You know, Mike, you talked about the character that Nanar Visitor plays, having a connection to DC Fontana. You know, this very idea of, well, what does it mean? I mean, the dream means different things in different contexts, doesn't it? We have the dreamer and the dream, but we also, and who is dreaming and who's real, but we also have the dream, to me, is a metaphor for Star Trek, for science fiction, for allegory, in a sense, mm-hmm. because the argument is that this story is going to be permissible if it's a dream, and not if it's ostensibly reality. And we saw the same thing with Gene Roddenberry. You know, one of the reasons that we got Star Trek in the first place was because he had this show, The Lieutenant, and he did an episode there dealing with race relations in the armed forces and racism. And it was so incendiary that the network refused to show it, and the show got pulled off the air, basically. And this was one of the reasons that he came up with this idea of developing Star Trek, where we put everything in space, we put it several hundred years in the future, we make it, in a sense, a dream. We make it a fantasy rather than a depiction or of sort of ostensible reality. So for me, that's sort of my basic understanding of what this episode is about. But then it leaves me with this slight question: what is it about on its own terms? And I always struggle a bit with that final scene where Sisko has this line: "What if Benny Russell's out there dreaming of me?" I find it hard, as much as I love this episode, to take that thought seriously, because to me it seems reasonably clear that I understand what's happened in that episode as Sisko is having a personal emotional crisis, his friend has died, etc. The prophets are sending him a vision, and the vision is sort of geeing him up to get back to work and to do what he has to, and to fulfill his destiny. So I suppose that's what I see it as, that then there's this sort of question, so what is this story telling him? Because it's such an awful experience that he gets put through in the person of Benny Russell. He experiences this kind of crushing, humiliating, the worst kind of prejudice, the worst kind of a sort of structural abuse of that time in history that he's living through. And I suppose my assumption is that maybe the reason that it kind of galvanizes him is that Benny Russell is willing to stake everything. He's willing to stake his sort of personal safety, his career, his sanity, because, you know, the next time we see him, he's been carted off to a mental institution. He has basically a breakdown at the end of the mm-hmm. episode. Everything on this thing, this dream of the future that's going to be better, and he will give everything to it. And maybe that's what we see when we get back to Sisko in the, you know, in air quotes, real world, that he's sort of making this, it's this, what his father says, you know, I fought the good fight, I kept the faith, and so on. It's like, even if it destroys him, even if winning this war is going to cost him his life or his mind or whatever it is, basically there's no cost too high. And it sort of recommits him to that. But I suppose one of the things that's interesting about the episode is, that's my interpretation of it, having watched it many years and thought about it over the years and struggled with what does it mean and what are we supposed to take from it. And it is quite ambiguous. There is a lot of room. There are a lot of gaps to kind of fill in ourselves. It's also, just as a piece of drama, a fantastic, you know, slice of 1950s sort of set social commentary. I mean, I was watching it last week. My partner hates Star Trek, hates science fiction altogether. And she walked into the room, I was watching that, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm watching Star Trek." She said, "That's not Star Trek." And she sat and watched it for a bit. I think she got quite involved in it, but she was basically, "No, that's not Star Trek. I don't accept that's Star Trek." And it also has amazing, you know, amazing performance from Avery Brooks, amazing René Auberjonois, I think, is, you know, that's one of his best performances as that editor character, a really interesting character and really sort of blistering performance. So it's, you know, rightly a real jewel in the kind of, you know, Star Trek crown, but also one that is very open to interpretation, that leaves a lot of gaps to kind of fill in yourself, I suppose.
Duncan, you made an interesting point that this episode is a type of meta-commentary or self-reflective commentary on the nature of Star Trek in general, maybe science fiction in general, maybe more broadly than that, utopian thinking in general. I mean, one of the most common criticisms is that kind of utopian, futuristic, progressive thinking doesn't reflect the nature of reality, doesn't reflect genuine human nature, doesn't reflect It maybe reflects our hopes and our optimism and our the best version of ourselves, our best vision of ourselves, but doesn't reflect reality in some way. So
I think it's interesting. I mean, I suppose Deep Space Nine of all the Star Trek series is the one that does reflect our reality in a sense. It's the most human. It's the most gritty. It's the most interested in flawed characters. And I also think one of the things that's interesting about this episode is it's so explicitly about race and racism and American history. And it's interesting in some ways to compare the representation of race in Deep Space Nine with the representation of gender in Voyager, because you have the first black captain, you have the first female captain. And I think that in some ways you might say that Voyager is a sort of post-feminist representation. It's sort of all these things are taken for granted. The fact that the captain is a woman is sort of pushed out of the way to a certain extent. We don't really want to focus on that. There are kind of anxieties about it on a production level. You know, we know the chaos that went on about Kate Mulgrew's hair, which is a kind of displacement of worrying about having a woman in the captain's chair. But at the same time, on the sort of surface of the stories, they were very keen not to foreground that, to kind of try and treat that as, well, we're in the future, we've moved past all that. Deep Space Nine, interestingly, you know, there is an element of that. I mean, no one is explicitly racist to Sisko in the sort of 24th century context because of the fact that he's a black man. But at the same time, he's very aware of the history of racism, the history of, you know, in America particularly, there's that episode, Bada Bing, Bada Bang, where they go to help out Vic. And for a long time, he's basically saying, I'm not participating in this this holo program. I think it's wrong. I don't want to, you know, sort of condone that version, a whitewashing of history, in a sense. And I suppose, Zachary, what you're talking about this idea of like the future being all perfect and all the problems have been solved, the danger is that we sort of forget where the challenges were and forget where those kind of systems of oppression or inequality were. And I think Deep Space Nine is quite interesting because it doesn't let you totally forget that. So it's saying this is the future and we've got a black captain, but we're not going to totally ignore what's gone before historically.
At the same time, though, the fact that we can sit and mention Captain Janeway's hair in this conversation says to me that Deep Space Nine does a better job of getting racism out of the way, showing that it's something that has been overcome in the 24th century. Yes, there are episodes like this one that draw attention to racism in our current society, right? So there, it's not like it abandons the concept altogether. But in the portrayal of the future, I would say that there's more progressiveness about race in Deep Space Nine than there is about gender in Voyager.
Yeah.
Well, I think in Voyager, it's just kind of it's sort of not an issue. That's the sense that I get. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, I mean, Voyager is great, and I understand, you know, having these women, particularly, I think, quite, you know, not just having the female captain, but having the chief engineer be female, having the women occupy all of these kind of traditionally male roles, the kind of command role, the fact that Janeway is also a scientist, the fact that B'Elanna is an engineer, the fact that, you know, Seven is a scientist, essentially, they are the ones on that ship who know how it works. Do you know what I mean? The men are kind of standing around like klutzes half the time. They wouldn't know what to do with it if those women weren't there. But it's kind of, it's not an issue. It's that's a sort of structural aspect of the way the show is composed that you maybe don't even really notice. And, you know, on the other hand, it has a great impact. And we've heard about all the women who went into science, technology, medicine, these kind of fields, because they were inspired by those characters to think, well, women can be scientists, they can be engineers and so on. But it was kind of very much like a non-issue as far as that show was concerned.
But in Voyager, I feel like I can still feel the struggles of the writers trying to balance Captain Janeway's role as a commander with her feminine side. Same thing with B'Elanna, her role as chief engineer with her feminine side. I don't get the sense that the writers struggle with how to make Captain Sisko balance his role as commander or as captain with his being of African-American descent.
No, that's true. But I think maybe that's just that the writers on Deep Space Nine are... this sounds a bit harsh, but better, essentially. I think they're better writers, and they're more able to cope with that kind of, you know. And also, we know that there was a lot more interference with Voyager. They were a lot more in the spotlight. Do you know what I mean? I mean, like Ira Stephen Baer will talk about this, that at a certain point, they didn't exactly wash their hands of Deep Space Nine, but they sort of felt, well, this is the weird one. We'll just kind of let them do their own thing. This is not where all our hopes and dreams are pinned. There's not so much riding on it somehow. And maybe that helped, so there wasn't that kind of anxiety. Whereas the thing with Kate Mulgrew's hair, it's really just a kind of, it's like a sort of pathology almost, isn't it? It's like people freaking out, these kind of executives not knowing how to cope with what they were doing. Have they made a terrible decision? I mean, even quite late in the casting process for Voyager, they were considering, should we actually have a male captain after all, I think, weren't they? You know, they weren't totally committed to this idea, and they saw it. I think they saw it as much more of a big deal having a female captain as opposed to having a black captain.
There's definitely an element of executive level groupthink going on with Voyager that doesn't seem to be happening in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, yeah, thankfully.
I just think, again, you mentioned that your partner was not really interested. She's saying that this isn't really Star Trek, but for me, this is very much Star Trek. This is about as Star Trek as it gets. It's this really fascinating exploration of the human condition, and you know, nary a phaser was fired in order to. You know, in order to drive the point home. And I think you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head. The very first time I watched this, it was Sisko weighing the cost of this war. He's lost a friend. He's, you know, and we kind of revisit this from time to time, just the frustrations of seeing those names on these casualty reports. And really, this is something that gnaws at him. And so he's weighing the cost of the war, and you know, rightly so, this vision that he's been given takes him back and shows him, you know, this struggle for equality as it was in the 1950s, and you know, the high cost of that equality that he's enjoying now in the 24th century. And so, you know, he does at the end of the episode, I think he finds his resolve and he realizes that, you know, it is worth it. It's worth whatever, you know, whatever if it costs us more lives, if it costs me my sanity, then, you know, doggone it, I'm going to do it because it's worth it. But I just love the ambiguity at the end of the episode and how they wrap this up. And kind of these deep philosophical questions that they end up asking that really, and to some degree, has nothing to do with the point that they're making. That's the brilliance, I think, of Deep Space Nine and the way that they write their episodes. There's oftentimes, you know, these deep ideas that they convey without ever really digging into the plot. Sometimes they do it with a B story that, and Deep Space Nine really has this thing about their B stories sometimes being even more compelling than their A plot. And again, it's just the brilliance of the writing team. And I should say that Avery Brooks directed this episode and it was just brilliantly directed, not just brilliantly acted, but brilliantly directed.
I was just going to say, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I should have said that before. Yes, to me, it is Star Trek. And that is one of the things that is so consistently great about Star Trek is that it is a format. It's a very flexible format. I wrote a thing last year for a website asked me to come up with like my top Star Trek episodes, and I found that very difficult to do, but what I ended up doing was categorizing them. So I had for each series like an essential, so my essential episodes that kind of embodied that series, its essence in a sense, and then the kind of I call them the sky's the limit, the kind of flights of fancy in a sense. And I think really you can't, Star Trek has to be both, do you know what I mean? And as much as each series has its own quality and its own character and its own kind of tone, they also all have the potential to just knock it out of the park, to do something totally off the wall, so totally unexpected. I mean, this is such an unexpected approach to, if you take it on that kind of level of like, okay, so if you read it sort of almost as Sisko would, so he's in a bad situation, he needs a vision, he needs an experience that's going to change him. This is the last thing that you might think would be that they would put him, do you know what I mean? That the nature of the trial that they put him through is it surprising to have that outcome. But that's what's interesting about it. You know, it's kind of, it is that sort of flight of fancy. It is a kind of, you know, that's what's so creative about it, I suppose. It's you know, that's what they do best in a way, you know, and it is like, I don't know, The Inner Light or, you know, one of these episodes that really breaks the format, breaks your expectations of, you know, what a Star Trek episode is going to be, and gives you something totally new and totally different and interesting. And you know, in this story, it works. You care about all these characters. They're only on screen for, you know, for one episode. I mean, even, you know, the Cassidy Yates character, you know, the girlfriend, you know what she wants. You know what her life is. You know her background. Do you know what I mean? You mm-hmm. get to know these people. And that is partly the level, the quality of the writing and the density of it and the amount that they pack in. And also the commitment that those actors bring to realizing these new characters who aren't their characters in a, you know, for the most part, in a very real and serious way. I think that they take it seriously as a piece of art that they're creating, as a, you know, as a kind of play of the week that they're putting on, and they imbue it with a lot of that reality. And Avery Brooks, of course, as a director, imbues it with a lot of that as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Duncan, you have, according to my list, you have one more pick, and then each of us have an honorable mention that will rapid fire here as we draw to a close.
Okay, so my last pick is Waltz, and I chose this episode for a number of reasons. I think a bit like I mentioned with Rocks and Shoals, one of the things I like about this episode is I think it raises several different questions. Just briefly to get this one out of the way, the B-plot is a kind of familiar Star Trek dilemma, I suppose, in that it's a kind of needs of the many versus the needs of the one set up. You know, are the crew of the Defiant going to follow their orders and protect the convoy, or are they going to endanger the convoy and go and rescue Sisko because he's their captain? And we sort of see the different permutations of that and the arguments of that, with Worf on the one hand saying they have to follow their orders, and Julian on the other hand saying, well, I don't think it's worth sacrificing the captain's life for that. And we also have this interesting situation where there's this opportunity to misconstrue Kira's transmission and say they haven't heard it. And Julian and O'Brien are basically advocating that, to basically say, oh, it was all garbled. We couldn't make sense of it. It reminds me of Nelson apparently put the telescope up to his blind eye to claim that he hadn't seen the order that he was being given, basically, mm-hmm. so that he could, you know, could he had a sort of basis for ignoring orders in that way. But ultimately, you know, that's not Worf's way. He decides to follow it, and this is a kind of companion piece to a later episode, Change of Heart, yes. where he does the opposite in a sense. So I think that's quite interesting. But again, that's just the B story. That's kind of well-trodden Star Trek ground. I suppose the bulk of the episode and what interests me about it is this idea about war crimes, guilt, Dukat on trial in a sense. And on one level, that's sort of what we have here. And there is this very strong parallel with the war trials after the Second World War. The fact that Dukat is being taken off to be sort of arraigned for this trial that's going to happen, which is going to investigate his conduct. And I assume, from my understanding, this is going to investigate his conduct, not just in the recent occupation, which was quite mild, but in the original occupation for which he's never been brought to any kind of justice. I mean, he was kind of allowed to get on with his life in that situation, but I guess the politics are different. And I think it's a fascinating story. It's fascinating on a sort of personal level. You have this kind of Misery-style story where Sisko's kind of, you know, almost held captive by Dukat. A fascinating thing about Dukat as a character is we never know whether to trust anything that he says. And the way the episode is constructed, there's a lot of aspects where Dukat is telling Sisko things that have happened. For example, that this other guy died trying to escape the ship. Now, we might well suspect that Dukat's probably killed him. This whole story he tells about how he was throwing up in the night and he had to clean up his sick. And you sort of think, well, is that just another mind game? Because he's someone who has so little respect for the truth. Everything he says is about trying to sort of construct this narrative. They're old friends. He's helping Sisko. It's a real investigation into how slippery Dukat is as a character. And that in itself is connected to this issue of what is his responsibility? What is his responsibility for the crimes of the occupation? He wants to know, does Sisko agree with the kind of mainstream view, which is that he was this awful man who sent people to their deaths and that he was an evil man and deserves to be punished? And we see, I guess, what Sisko says to him when he's trying to, you know, because he is basically trapped. He says what he thinks Dukat wants to hear. He says, you were a soldier, you had to carry out your orders. This is what legally is known as the Nuremberg defence, because this is the defence that was given at the Nuremberg war crime trials. My understanding is that it doesn't it doesn't carry any weight. If you know that the orders are wrong, if you know that the orders are illegal or immoral, actually that defence doesn't stand up legally. And I suppose this episode, it raises this question, you know, was de Kock just following orders? Is he fully responsible for the crimes that are committed under his watch? And it also ties into this idea, you know, there was a very famous book about the Second World War, Hitler's Willing Executioners, which I suppose was sort of arguing that actually it wasn't a case of people just following orders that they knew were morally wrong, that there was a kind of army of people who were happy to go along with these things. And I suppose, and so the situation of guilt in that situation is rather different. So I guess it asks all these questions. Where does the guilt stand? Where is responsibility in a situation like that, where there's a kind of structural arrangement that is creating this kind of oppressive situation? And it also touches on another aspect, of course, about the Holocaust, which you know, we know about, which is this idea of kind of denialism, Holocaust denial, the stories that people tell. De Kock is obsessed with constructing a narrative that suits his interests. He's he's such a sort of self-aggrandizing person. He wants to present himself and Sisko and their relationship in a certain way. He wants to present his relationship to the Bajorans in a certain way. And it's hard to know. I suppose the episode asks us constantly to question, is de Kock an evil man? I mean, this is what it comes down to at the end. Is he an evil man, or is he sort of deranged, essentially? And obviously, at this point, he's had this breakdown. He's having hallucinations. We can see he's mad, ostensibly. But at the same time, it sort of makes you think, was there always something wrong with him? What is this obsession he has with wanting the Bajorans to like him? There's something off about de Kock, even from the beginning. And so it sort of, it asks these quite interesting and, again, slightly ambiguous questions. And I think one of the interesting things about the end of the episode is it almost gives you both answers, because Sisko tells him he's not an evil man because he didn't commit genocide, even though he wanted to. And then in the next scene, he tells Dax, no, this man is the, you know, embodiment of all evil, essentially. So it sort of raises these questions around guilt, around sanity, around these sort of things. But it also raises a question that actually was, in some ways, the thing that I most wanted to bring to you two, because I'm interested to know, because from a historical point of view, this isn't a question that I don't think is something that I would address particularly, but from a philosophical point of view, this is an important question, which is, what is evil? And if we're saying, is he or is he not an evil man, is evil a characteristic or a property? Is it like generosity? Is it like, you know, like bitterness? Is it something that's an inherent sort of human quality? Is it a kind of imminent force in the world? Is it a thing which, I guess, from a sort of theological perspective, maybe you might see evil as almost a sort of supernatural thing. It's something that exists in the world in some way in itself. Or is it, and this is what I sort of wonder looking at the example of de Kock, is it more like, you know, if we think about, say, a psychopath, we might think of that in kind of mental health terms, as there's some kind of brain, there's something missing in terms of that person's personality, their mental sort of setup. You know, is it a kind of absence of empathy, an absence of a kind of normal brain development that leads to someone who doesn't have a sense of right or wrong? So I suppose it raises all these interesting questions, and I partly wanted to bring it because I was kind of curious to know what you two, from your different perspectives, where you would come to this idea of what, you know, what evil is. How do you understand evil? Is it something you believe in, and what do you think it means?
I think this is a really complicated question. First of all, with de Kock, I don't think it's easy at all to tell whether he is evil in the sense of knowing things are wrong and doing them anyway, or whether he's really drunk his own Kool-Aid at this point. You know, does he believe his own narrative? Does he frame all the information that he gets from the world around him in terms of this narrative that he's constructed about himself and the Bajorans and whatnot? And I think, you know, there's this deep point that, you know, maybe we're all like that. We all have our worldview, we have our narratives, and we view reality through those lenses. So it's not even just a question of what actions you're doing versus what actions you're not doing, you know, because all of de Kock's actions are filtered through his own narrative. And it could be that's a manipulative narrative. Maybe he knows better and he's just constructed this for the sake of achieving some evil end. But it could be that he really believes his own story at this point, in which case he becomes a much more sympathetic character. I think it's not easy at all to distinguish between genuine cases of evil and other cases, cases of acrasia or weakness of will. And just doing something bad doesn't make you an evil person. We all make mistakes. We know better, but we don't have the strength to act morally or admirably sometimes. I think one of the, if I were looking for a place to distinguish genuine evil from, whatever lower cases of wrongdoing would be that aren't evil in some really strong sense, I would say the best connection I could come up with is probably has to do with like virtue ethics, habits of character. You know, doing the occasional bad thing doesn't make you an evil person. Right. Everyone does that, right? Doing something wrong habitually over time, making that part of your essential character, shapes you into something more like an evil person. So with Ducat, it might come down to a question of what's the pattern of his character? Are these one-off instances, or does he believe his own narrative, in which case he's more sympathetic, or has he developed the habit of just doing bad again and again and again, and that's become who he is from a virtue ethics character standpoint? I don't think it's easy at all, because it's not just a question of are you doing good actions or bad actions, because it's a question of are you doing those actions, good or bad actions over time habitually? Are you doing it through a narrative that is more sympathetic, that makes more sense, that is in line with your worldview, that you think is positive? And I think from the external viewer standpoint, you can't get inside someone's head very easily. So we genuinely don't know about Ducat, which is it? Is he an evil man who does bad again and again and again? Or is he, does he believe his own story? Is he drunk his own Kool-Aid? In which case, we might still find fault with what he's doing, but he may not be evil because we can understand his narrative when we look in, but we can't peek inside his head and we can't peek inside anyone's head. So it's really hard to distinguish those cases. They, conceptually and abstractly, they can be distinguished. I can distinguish between someone who is, just makes a mistake and, does a one-off instance of wrong. Someone who believes a narrative that is not based in reality, but they genuinely believe the narrative. And so all their actions are funneled in terms of that. And someone who is genuinely evil that has developed terrible habits of character over a long period of time. From the external perspective, I don't think you can make that distinction very well. It's a question of intention. And, like you experience in any court trial, you can't get at someone's intentions very easily. All you can do is look at their actions. You can ask them a bunch of questions and hope that reveals something about their intentions and their character. But insofar as we, from a legal standpoint, insofar as we build intention into the nature of a crime, this is the reason we make distinctions between first degree murder and manslaughter, right? Mm-hmm. It's a question of intention. And that's one of the hardest things to reveal, because it's not a question of the action. It's a question of someone's mental state, which we have at best indirect access to.
It's also, speaking legally, insanity is a defense, or at least a mitigating factor in a legal situation. And I suppose, Ducat's lawyers, given the breakdown that he has, would be well placed to argue some kind of insanity defense, I suppose. But I think part of the problem with him as well is that he is someone who, yes, he buys into his own narrative, but he also has such contempt for any kind of objective truth, in a sense, that it's very hard to know. I mean, it's an interesting parallel with Garrick. We have with Garrick this idea, that he lies the whole time. He lies as a matter of habit. He lies because he thinks it's good practice. You have to carry on lying. I think with Ducat, there's something, it's more complicated than that. And maybe it is because he believes his own lies. But there's a point in this episode where he tells Sisko he wants the truth. And Sisko tells him, what do you know about the truth? You don't really believe in the truth somehow. I mean, Ducat is the kind of ultimate, post-truth alternative facts embodiment, right? That kind of the extension of that line of thinking, basically. He can spin anything into one of these narratives in which he's hard done by, in which he's unappreciated, in which he's, or as he wants in this situation, he's respected by his enemy. He respects him as a noble antagonist, when in fact it's not really the case. He's so absorbed in these narratives. That's what it seems to me. It's not so much about, and it's not really, I mean, I mentioned alternative facts. It's not really so much the facts. It's the kind of, it's the interpretation, it's the story. What's his role? Who is he in the story that he's telling? Because it's constantly shifting, and he can't cope with anything without placing it as part of one of these kind of grand narratives which has him at the centre of it.
Well, it's hard for me philosophically because I want to veer this towards a discussion about epistemology and the nature of truth in general. If the nature of truth is such that there's an objective reality and facts are either true or false about that, then if someone is misunderstanding the facts, then you can ask why, right? You can ask, well, are they insane? Are they intentionally ignoring, you know, the something that disproves their narrative? You know, but that's all in terms of this objective sense of true versus false, reality versus interpretation. On a deeper, more postmodern, post-truth kind of way of interpreting the situation, you could say that we all view whatever facts we perceive about the world through our narratives about ourselves, through our worldview, mm-hmm. through the items that are so ingrained in our worldview that they are the measure by which we, as individuals or as a society, evaluate truth. So if Dukat has developed this narrative about himself that is a fundamental, crucial, you know, tightly woven part of his worldview in some sort of you know, coherence theory sense, right? He's built this consistent worldview with himself at the middle. So what he does is view every fact about the world through the lens of his own worldview. And I guess the temptation is to say from the other interpretation of reality, which is more granted in objectivity, you can say, well, he's just ignoring the facts at that point. You know, he's disregarding the nature of reality in constructing that narrative. On the other hand, you could say, well, we all do that. We all have our narratives. We all have these stories or data points that are crucial to our worldviews. And those are the lens through which we measure reality in general. So whenever you encounter something that doesn't match your narrative, you have to ask, do I try to incorporate this into my narrative? Do I reject it because it conflicts with my narrative? You know, we look at the world through our worldviews. And if that's the case, that's a perfectly rational activity because we all do that. You know, we've got a scientific worldview. So if you encounter something that's not scientific, you run it through your scientific worldview lens. If you have a religious worldview and you encounter something that doesn't match your worldview, you run it through your religious worldview lens. Dukat has his Dukat worldview lens with himself at the center. So he's running everything through that narrative about himself. But I would say on that post-objectivity, more postmodern view of truth, that's not an inherently irrational activity like it would be on the view of truth as something more objective.
Right. I definitely predict a future episode of Metatrex where we delve into the nature of evil and what is evil. Certainly. This particular episode, you know, there's definitely a psychosis involved. He's had some kind of psychotic episode. We don't know really if that's been something that's in play for his character from the beginning or whether that's directly related to this breakdown that he's had in light of Zial, in light of her death. But I mean, he's like Gollum in this episode, you know, that he fixes my precious, you know, and he's having these conversations with different characters, and some of them are challenging him and pushing him, and others are agreeing with his warped sense of perspective. And so you really don't know how much that informs the overall character if it's isolated, but it's definitely a fascinating, and I have to say that Mark Alimo is super, super creepy in this episode, and he just is, in terms of what he brought as an actor, I think it was well written, but it was incredibly acted, and I think we have to acknowledge that when we're talking in terms of, you know, an essential episode, I think his portrayal of Gul Dukat is what sells this episode for what it is, and that is a really powerful exploration of Gul Dukat and this waltz that he has between the truth and his own warped narrative of what's going on around him.
One of my honorable mentions that I almost didn't mention was The Reckoning. And you asked a question about evil. And in this episode, we get to see kind of this diametric opposition between the prophets and the Pa Wraiths in a very sort of religious, metaphysical, good versus evil sense. So if you're asking the question about good versus evil, there's this historical sense that evil is kind of diametrically opposed to good. So you've got, you know, very good characters that are noble, that have principles, versus the evil people or the evil spiritual beings that are diametrically opposed to that. With Dukat, we get something a lot more subtle, right? He's not evil in this diametrically opposed sense like the Pa Wraiths. He's willing to do a deal with the devil, though. and he's willing to compromise, and he's willing to disregard any counter evidence, anything that doesn't conflict with his narrative. So I would say if we're looking for a way to identify Dukat as evil, it would be his intentional disregard for personal growth, for improvement in society, for responding to counter evidence against his own worldview. He has this utter intentional disregard for anything that doesn't fit with his worldview. And I think if you're going to be sort of intellectually and maybe morally honest, even there's a humility to that, being willing to admit that you're wrong, being willing to consider new evidence, to consider someone else's viewpoint, to realize that you have personal failings that need attention. And Dukat seems to have this persistent, over time, intentional disregard for anything that conflicts with his worldview, to the point where I would say it's stronger than being so immersed in his worldview that he can't see those things. I think he sees there are genuine contradictions and genuine tensions, and people have genuine criticisms of him, and he's just to the point where he's intentionally disregarding any of it because it doesn't fit in with his narrative. So it's that intentional component that leads me to think that there is an element of evil in Dukat, mm-hmm. because he has this blatant disregard for improvement.
Mm. I wonder, I mean, it's interesting when you use this idea of intentional disregard, it sort of makes me think, is there, because there's this whole question hanging over his behavior about how sane he is, whether...
He's losing it towards the end. Reality.
Definitely in this episode. But you see, this episode makes me start to question how sane was he ever? Do you know what I mean? Were there kind of seeds of this even going back during the occupation? Because some of his behaviour there, it seems quite... it seems like there's more going on. There's something sort of simmering under the surface, in a sense. And it just made me wonder, when you said this is someone who has an intentional disregard for the truth, maybe someone who loses respect for the truth to that extent, it almost inevitably begins to lose touch with reality. And in a sense, he's, by constructing so many lies, by constructing so many stories, he can't necessarily, he'd have to split his mind. He'd have to be kind of able to maintain one narrative of how he really thinks everything is, and then all these other narratives of how he's trying to persuade other people things are. And the fact is that those things are going to get blurred, and he's going to kind of lose that perspective, in a sense. So that's what it sort of makes me wonder, whether it's actually the fact that he's a man who has no respect for truth and believes that everything is a matter of perspective and spinning the right story kind of allows him to lose his grip, in a sense, and to be sort of subsumed into that. The other thing that he reminded me of, just from a sort of literary perspective, was because when we look at the occupation and the things that he says about his behaviour and the way that he treated the Bajorans, and he has a kind of explanation for everything. You know, I was being reasonable. I wanted to reduce the output of this. I wanted them to respect me in this way. He's sort of got it all worked out. It reminds me weirdly of Captain Ahab. You know, Captain Ahab in Moby Dick, he says, all my means are sane, my motive and my object mad. In other words, everything that I'm doing sort of ostensibly makes sense. I seem like a competent captain. I seem like the right man for the job to go and, you know, find this whale, etc. But the fact is, underneath all of that, there's something deep and passionate and kind of and wrong in that person's, in that man's character and his personality, that is motivating all this apparently rational, reasonable, factual sort of outward material.
Yeah, a minute ago you mentioned that there's something simmering inside Dukat, and I think that's a great description, because what I see in Dukat, and you mentioned Captain Ahab, and I think there's a great connection there, because there's kind of a resentment that Dukat has against reality, like against truth. Like, reality has wronged him. Reality refuses to fit into the narrative he's telling, and over time he's built up this resentment that's causing him to do progressively worse and worse things. And I mean, to some lesser degree, I think I've experienced that, where reality doesn't fit in my mold. And you start to go, wow, how come reality's not fitting into this vision I have for myself, or how the way things should be? And you can get this simmering resentment that, if you don't keep that in check, can really start to dominate your entire thinking, maybe lead you to do things that you shouldn't do. And I think that the fact that Dukat has this simmering resentment, it is very similar to Ahab. Ahab gets resentful at a certain point, and that leads to his destruction. I think Dukat has this simmering resentment. So it's not even just an intellectual disregard for truth. He has this emotional resentment against reality and against the people who are not fitting his narrative.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, going back to, I suppose, the very beginning of Deep Space Nine, you know, we sort of, that's the setup, isn't it? He's been rejected, in a sense, I suppose, by the Bajorans in a very direct way. He's lost his job being in charge.
And that was his office just 2 weeks ago.
That was his office, exactly. And it's, yeah. And it's kind of, and then it happens all over again. And you do feel sorry for him. I think in Sacrifice of Angels, I felt sorry for him. And this is a weird question as well, I think. I mean, you feel sorry for him because his daughter's killed, which is awful, but I actually felt sorry for him when he's almost on the verge of tears, where he says victory was within our grasp, we almost had it. He'd almost recaptured his narrative where he's at the center of things, he's in charge, he's the big man. And then, like you say, reality came and kind of came to bite him, in a sense, and he's been taken, you know, right back down again, and he can't cope with it. You know, that level of disappointment and of being rejected by events, in a sense, you know, not even by any individual person. I mean, he blames Sisko for it, but really just, you know, history didn't go his way, and he can't cope with it. It destroys him.
He's incapable of updating his narrative, although he does a little bit here. He incorporates the Pah Wraith thing into his narrative. So it's not like he's inflexible, but
in time,
but basically, in time he does, yeah, he, reality has a way of conflicting with your narratives, right? Reality will catch up to you eventually for most of us. Right. And, I think Dukat just has this utter inflexibility in terms of his narrative. He can't adjust and modify his narrative when reality confronts it. He's got to make reality and all the people in it by extension out to be the enemy of his narrative.
It reminds me strangely in an odd way, when we're talking about Dukat being a sympathetic character, feeling sorry for him, even though we think of him as an awful man. You know, obviously there are all these parallels with the Cardassians and the Nazis and so on. And Dukat is to some degree this sort of Hitler character. I don't know if you've seen that film Downfall, which was very controversial at the time it came out. Now it's sort of mainly known for all those memes where you just see that scene of Hitler getting angry and they you know, put fake subtitles underneath. You've probably seen them. But the controversy when that film came out was that the film does depict Hitler as a human being. And there is an element, however awful he is, of if you witness someone's sort of whole world collapsing, in a sense, his whole everything that he's built is falling down around him, you know, losing all his power, losing all his influence, losing everything. In some ways, you do feel a measure of sympathy towards that person. You can't help it as a human being. Do you know what I mean? However much you despise them and however much you disagree with them. And so I think that's one reason that film was very controversial, particularly in Germany, where they have quite strong rules about these things. And I suppose with Dukat, it's interesting that however awful he is, we can pity him to an extent because we can see how much he suffers as a result of exactly that kind of inflexibility and that kind of crisis.
It's tragic. It's always tragic to see someone's grand structures, you know, what the society they wanted to build, the narrative they've told about themselves, be revealed as a house of cards that collapses very easily. I mean, no matter what the narrative is, it's a tragic situation to see your grandest mental creation collapse into a house of cards.
When Dukat brings the Pah Wraiths into the scenario, I think at that point we do really delve into kind of the theological ideas of what is evil. And I think this will definitely be a topic that will pop up on a future episode of Metatrex, and I don't really want to get into it at this point because we've gone quite long here. But I think there are a lot of layers to this idea of what is evil, and Dukat's character really explores each of those layers, I think, in a very unique way.
In terms of the Pah Wraiths and the theological element of good versus evil, I would say one thing that is noteworthy is the way in which evil is constantly masquerading as good. You know, evil is seductive, right? Mm-hmm. Evil is constantly whispering in your ear. It's like the depiction of the devil and the angel on the shoulders, right? Evil is always whispering in your ear, no, follow me. I'm the right path to follow. Mm-hmm. And it's not as, it's not as easy to discern as it seems like it should be at first glance. You can be seduced into being evil through a narrative, through a story, through a lens that is ultimately counterproductive and ultimately defeating and ultimately evil. But those initial first steps can seem very plausible and seem like the right thing to do. So I would say that this seductive element of evil, you know, in a way, Dukat gets seduced into being what he, you know, who he is and what he is.
We're given two concepts in the Christian Bible, and one is that the devil or evil itself will always take on the most pleasant form possible. In the Garden of Eden, it was a serpent, and I know that seems not so positive in today's society, in today's narrative, but we're told that at that point in time, the serpent was the most subtle of all the beasts of the field. And so...
Smooth talking.
Yes, smooth talking, absolutely. And interestingly enough, you know, we're warned that, you know, the devil has the ability to come to us in the form of an angel of light. And we're also told in the Christian Bible that there is a way that seems right to a man. So you have these two forces at play here, but both of them have an objective of taking us down a path of evil, and the end result is, you know, is condemnation. And so I think you hit the nail on the head, Zachary.
There's something interesting about this smooth talking aspect of a serpent, because Dukat is serpentine in this regard,
he is.
Right? He's a smooth talker. Mm-hmm. He's a suave guy when he wants to be. So he can take this narrative and spin this very eloquent story about it that is seductive in the sense of a serpent in the Garden of Eden.
Well, and even the makeup of Cardassians is, I mean, the makeup of Cardassians even sort of alludes to serpents, I think. Do you know what I mean? They look like cobras, mm-hmm. almost, don't they? There's that kind of... You know, that I think that's there in the kind of visual regime that we associate with them.
They're smooth talking like the Romulans are smooth talking, too. I mean, this is the distinction between, say, the Romulans and the Klingons. The Klingons are kind of this scary Cold War figure, but they're not smooth talkers, right? Mm. The Romulans are the smooth talkers of the bunch that are more seductive in this kind of evil sense. The Cardassians are more like that. So they do look like serpents, absolutely. But the Dukat in particular, he's a smooth talker. You know, I think someone who is susceptible to being drawn in by a narrative could be really taken in by Dukat's smooth talking.
Well, Duncan mentioned earlier the relationship between Dukat and Kira Nerys in season 6. And that in and of itself is a great illustration of this, because there is a point where he's just about seduced her into thinking he's a good guy. And, you know, I think about the episode, he buys her a dress and we're going to get together and celebrate Zial's art, and she's buying into it. And then suddenly she realizes, you know, oh my gosh, I'm losing sight of, you know, what he really is, what he really represents. And, you know, she comes to herself. But I think that illustrates that so well. He's a smooth operator. He's able to bend the narrative. He's charming. He's suave. He's sophisticated. But the intention behind that, at least in terms of what they paint for us, is that it's evil. He's evil. And so, you know, we have that to inform us. But, you know, in the midst of that, it's almost like Mark Alimo is an actor. He's trying very, very hard to break that mold a little bit. And it really adds these nuances to the character that I think really encapsulates oftentimes what evil is. And that's, on the surface, something that can be very, very charming, very seductive. But...
And it's those nuances that make it hard to distinguish whether Dukat is genuinely evil or whether he believes his own narrative. Mm-hmm. But I think that's true of evil in general, right? Evil almost never just shows itself like, here I am, evil, come follow me. It's more seductive than that and subtler than that, and very difficult to distinguish right from wrong or good from evil sometimes, at least at first glance, or those first steps along an evil path.
Yeah.
And it's not always the big things, because I suppose it's interesting you mentioned that scene, Mike, with the dress. I feel like that is almost the most quintessential Dukat scene that we get in Deep Space Nine, because he's so charming, and he's so, you know, polite, and he's sent Kira this present. She gives it back, And he immediately palms it off on his daughter, and his daughter buys into it and thinks he's a lovely dad and how much he cares about her. And that is Descartes, really. That is Descartes' contempt for truth, integrity, honesty. In a moment, he turns that kind of humiliation, the dress has been sent back, into an opportunity to control someone else, in a sense, by lying to them. And he does it so smoothly, so easily. And he kind of accepts the compliment in this kind of sort of modest way of, you know, well, I try to be a good father or whatever. It's just so creepy and so sleazy. And I suppose that's the thing. It's a small thing. But, you know, that is a man you should never trust for a second because he has no ethics, I suppose, really, does he? He's just a kind of moral void somehow.
It reminds me of, Mike, you'll appreciate the reference. It reminds me of Satan walking back and forth, or, you know, to and fro in the book of Job.
Yes, Job.
Exactly. I feel like Ducat is fishing, right? He's taken this dress. He tries it on Kira. Mm. It doesn't work. So he takes the dress. He's going to go fishing with someone else until he can find someone who will reinforce his narrative. And he's fishing. He's you know, wandering to and fro.
Yes. Yes. That reference from Job, of course. Yes. Excellent.
Looking for approval from, you know, from one or other of them, yeah.
Or someone who can be manipulated, you know, yeah. Approval, right. Or both, yeah, right? Yeah. I think that's what's subtle about Ducat is there's this emotional need for approval that Ducat has that is not the entire driving force, but it's this emotional approval, and he's figured out he can be manipulative. So he's manipulating while simultaneously seeking approval, seeking admiration.
Yes.
Mm. And the sad thing is that Zial really does admire him. I mean, she buys into all of this because, you know, she's a very naive, sort of innocent character in a sense, and she doesn't really see him for who he is because she, you know, he's a very persuasive person, and she's credulous in a way that Kira, although momentarily she may sort of buy into it, that she has more skepticism about Descartes, I suppose, generally, whereas Zial is just, she can't see it, and that's, you know, that's part of the what's sort of tragic about their relationship in a sense is her not being able to see him for who he is and not being able to recognize, you know, that he may be her father. And I suppose she has this in common with Kira. You know, Kira has this issue with her mother that we talked about, and she can't really accept what her mother's done, but she's still her mother. So ultimately that's why she says she saves her life. You know, Zial has this, her father's an awful person, but he is still her father.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Zachary, you mentioned The Reckoning being one of your honorable mentions. Do you have any others?
Oh, no. My other was Far Beyond the Stars that we've already mentioned.
Okay. And, Duncan, lightning round, any other honorable mentions on your list?
My other honorable mention was Inquisition, which is the episode that introduces Section 31. I mean, obviously, you could say a lot about Section 31 and the kind of consequentialist ethics surrounding that as a concept. I was sort of interested more in a way in what it means to be a Manchurian candidate. You know, this idea that basically Dr. Bashir essentially is a Manchurian candidate. He's been brainwashed to do something that he's apparently not aware of. Is a kind of interesting a concept in a sense. I saw a show a few years ago here where there's a guy who's a sort of hypnotist called Derren Brown, and he supposedly hypnotized someone to the gun was firing blanks, but he thought he was assassinating Stephen Fry, and he actually went through with this act to try and prove that it was possible to hypnotize someone into doing something like this. It was quite interesting anyway, but it sort of raised some moral questions, though, because what Wayun tells Bashir, and this goes back to statistical probabilities, is that they didn't torture him, they didn't hypnotise him, they didn't do anything like that. They just rationally explained to him what we saw in statistical probabilities, that the Federation were not going to win. And so he made a rational decision and then allowed himself to be sort of brain wiped or whatever it is. And it sort of made me wonder, is that something that Bashir would have done? If that is what he would have done, would it have been wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen Garak working against Cardassia in order to save Cardassia. We've sort of seen that issue. You know, and we've talked about this issue of when is it right to surrender or to almost sort of sabotage your own side's military strategy. And what are the sort of ethics of accepting defeat or sort of working towards defeat? And one of the things that struck me about this season generally is that I think there's almost a little metaphor there in the holodeck programs that Miles and Julian play. They start off playing the Battle of Britain. The Battle of Britain, famous example of a victory clutched from the jaws of defeat. You know, it should never have been successful. It was, you know, Churchill called them the few, that we all owe so much to the few. These few pilots who, against the odds, managed to pull off this victory and change the course of history. Mm-hmm. They go from playing that a situation where they expect to lose and somehow win anyway, to the Alamo, which is an honourable defeat, and they know they're not going to win. And there's some sort of discussion about why would we want to play this thing that we're not going to win. And I think that Deep Space Nine keeps pushing us in the direction of thinking we're going to lose this war. You know, we know it's a TV drama, we know it's a narrative, we expect them to win, but we're going to lose. And you even have these little hints. There's an episode where Vic Fontaine sings a song about the losers, and this is about romantic love in that context. But again, they're these characters are being identified as losers in some sense. Yeah. They're not going to come out on top. They're not going to win. So I guess I sort of found that interesting, this idea of, A, what does it mean to sort of accept you're on the losing side and do something about it? But then B, if we do see him as a Manchurian candidate, you know, what are the kind of ethics of that? And obviously, this has a topical dimension because, you know, again, talking about the recent presidential election in America, there's a lot of questions outstanding about Russian involvement, you know, foreign influence in something like that. And, you know, even whether the president might not be aware of the extent to which they have been influenced or that they're following someone else's strategy or so on. So these are sort of topical issues, I suppose. So that was one that jumped out to me.
I'm glad you mentioned the holodeck antics of O'Brien and Bashir. I was actually going to bring that up when I was talking about Darker Than Death or Night, because that Alamo simulation is the kind of the B story in that episode. And again, this is just an example of where the B plot is as interesting or in some cases even more interesting than the A plot in these episodes. But I really like how these holodeck antics that they're having kind of inform at least how they see the direction of the war going, and really in a lot of ways the way we see the direction of the war as a viewer. It kind of informs how we see things going forward for them. So I'm glad you thought to mention that. The Inquisition was actually one of my honorable mentions, my final honorable mention as well, for all the reasons you mentioned. I really appreciate the way that they're able to twist reality in order to try and test Julian Bashir, his resolve, his ability to, you know, kind of keep a grip on reality and perceive the truth and how that informs his actions as opposed to what's going on immediately around him. So I thought it was a very fascinating episode and worthy of mentioning. So, gentlemen, I am going to quickly recap our picks, and then we'll collect any final thoughts. And then at that point, Duncan, would love to hear what you're working on and how our listeners can connect with you on the interwebs. So our essential episodes for Deep Space Nine: Rocks and Shoals, In the Pale Moonlight, Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night, Statistical Probabilities, Profit and Lace, Far Beyond the Stars, and Waltz. We have two honorable mentions that stand on their own that are not a part of that initial list, and that is The Reckoning and Inquisition. And that, listeners, is Essential Trek Philosophy for Deep Space Nine, Season 6. Gentlemen, any final thoughts?
Just that's a really impressive list. I think what impresses me about this season overall is the complexity and the nuances of the topics and issues that are explored, all in the context of season 6's overall story arc. It's not like we get one episode on these topics. There's a narrative and a tapestry. These issues are all interconnected and woven together over the course of the entire season. And that's quite a feat. It's an intellectual feat philosophically. It's a dramatic feat. You know, in terms of storytelling, it's a brilliant piece of writing. There it's no accident that I think I probably speak for all of us. This is one of the best seasons of Star Trek ever. For those reasons,
indeed,
absolutely, yeah, I agree. I think this is definitely one of the finest seasons of Star Trek. And also, I mean, this was coming out at the same time as season 4 of Voyager, one of the best seasons of Voyager. I mean, this was, you know, something was There's something they put the right stuff in the water fountain.
The glory days.
They were hitting the high notes at this time over at Paramount. But I mean, I suppose, and it interests me. I mean, I know I've banged on about the Second World War a lot in this discussion, and obviously that's sort of my area. But I do think that although we can look at episodes and see other historical parallels working in some of these war stories, I do think that quite explicitly, really, that the Second World War has a very strong influence on Deep Space Nine, on the Dominion War, but also obviously earlier, looking at the background to the series, even in the early seasons, about the occupation and the legacies of the occupation and the brutality of the occupation. And really, for me, as someone who's interested in occupation and is working on that subject, and frankly, probably some of my interest in that subject stems from watching Deep Space Nine as a teenager and being fascinated by these stories. It's something that's sort of never really left me, that interest. And I guess in a funny way, I think this season of Deep Space Nine probably delves into that subject of occupation in the most interesting ways, because first of all, you've got this, in the first six episodes, you've got this kind of rehash, this sort of milder rehash of the occupation, which raises a lot of interesting questions, this kind of model occupation, to put it in the Channel Islands context. Then you've got these other aspects, episodes that go back and look at the original occupation in different ways. So, you know, Wrong's Darker Than Death or Night, we literally go back to the occupation, and we've done that before, but this time we're seeing it from quite a personal perspective. We're seeing into Ducat's quarters, we're seeing this kind of, you know, this surprising aspect of that story. Waltz, obviously, we're debating the whole, that is the kind of war crimes trial. I mean, Descartes doesn't make it to his war crimes trial, to his sort of Nuremberg trial, but Sisko effectively stages it for him in that cave. So we kind of get that side. So for me, I suppose, although Wrong's Darker Than Death or Night was one of my honourable mentions rather than my core ones, in terms of the kind of occupation story of Deep Space Nine, I think that this season really brings it to a head in some very interesting ways and really kind of shines a lot more light onto that in some quite direct ways.
So, Duncan, I mentioned at the top of the episode that you are London-based. You're an author of several books, among which are Men of Letters. And, of course, we've talked here on the podcast before about Star Trek: The Human Frontier. What are you working on currently?
So the book I'm working on currently is a book about the Channel Islands occupation in the Second World War. Its working title is Hitler's British Isles. It should be out in probably, I guess, about a year or so. But I'm sort of hard at work on that at the moment. Just knee deep in all these interviews that I basically went there over the summer. I spent 3 months over there over the summer and interviewed about 100 or so people to try and get the sort of personal perspective of what it was like living side by side. I guess what interested me is not so much the resistance and the fighting and all that sort of thing, but, you know, what's it like having your enemy literally living in your spare room or going to the same shops or, you know, going to the beach and swimming in the same sea at the same time? And you know, what is it like having that kind of proximity to the people who, you know, your relatives are off fighting and finding, as they inevitably did, that, you know, they were human beings. They were actually, you know, for the most part, quite decent people. They didn't really have anything against the people of the Channel Islands. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't, on a sort of personal level, that conflict was sort of absent there. And they had the same experience that I guess a lot of people find in wars. I mean, in the First World War, you know, famously had the Christmas Truce, where the two sides realised that really the fighting men had a lot in common with each other. Mm-hmm. And it was only because they'd been ordered to fight each other that they were set against each other. So these are the kind of things that interest me about those sort of subjects.
And if our listeners want to connect with you on social media around the interwebs, how can they do that?
So you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Barrett's Books. That's RRETT. If you're interested in my book on Star Trek, The Human Frontier, that I talked about a bit last time, there's a website for that. It's www.StarTrekHumanFrontier.com. And you can find me in the Babel Conference quite often.
Duncan, we're glad you could join us today. Not only is this the perfect season for us to talk about with you on the podcast because it dovetails so nicely with your own interests, but personally, I just feel like I learned so much every time you're on the show. I mean, I could just sit and listen to you talk for 3 hours. I've learned so much about World War II in history and some of the connections that I haven't seen in this season of Star Trek that I've watched again and again and again. It's one of my favorite seasons. I just feel like I learned so much from you. So we're glad you could join us, and we want you to come back and join us again soon.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for having me again. Sorry, I was worried I'd sort of co-opted Metatrex into sort of historic treks.
Historic treks.
But I think with DS9, it's sort of legitimate to look at it through this kind of historical lens, because that's so much informing what the writers are doing. But thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Pleasure having you as well. Transporter Chief, I do believe the USS Britain is ready to receive Duncan back, so energize. Well, Zachary, that was fantastic having Duncan with us to talk about Essential Trek philosophy from Season 6 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I really appreciated his really in-depth perspectives and his thoughts, the parallels he was able to make to World War II, and kind of drawing out really some things in the discussion that I wasn't expecting. And as we mentioned before, we really wanted to take our time and let the conversation progress naturally, and it was a lengthy conversation. I'm glad we were able to capture it all.
I'm so glad we could have Duncan back on the podcast. We had him on Metatrex once before, and I learned so much every time we talked to Duncan, and we had such a deep dive into one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek, Season 6 of Deep Space Nine. I'm just glad we decided to make this a two-part episode, and we didn't cut out any of the great material and the great connections that Duncan brought to the table for our discussion today.
Yeah, definitely just too much good information, good perspectives, good insights for us to really cheat our listeners out of any of it. And I'm glad we decided to do this as a two-part episode. It's been a lot of fun. But this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I open up the garment bag and I see this like red tunic, like this top. I'm like, wait, this looks really familiar. Like, so I try it all on. I try on all the wardrobe. Everything fits great. And I look at myself in the mirror. I'm like, holy bleep. And I turn to the wardrobe supervisor. I said, is this Star Trek that I'm working on?
To the journey!
Leola is a substitute for any ingredient he doesn't have.
No sugar, Leola root.
Yeah. No bananas, Leola root.
No coffee,
Leola root.
Saturday morning trek.
Roddenberry was very involved with the first episode. And for that episode, we needed to come up with the derelict spaceship. And as a result, as the brand new guy on the crew who had spaceships and stuff in his portfolio, I got the job of coming up with that ship.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
I mean, obviously, you have Nicholas Meyer writing for your Star Trek show. Is there any way that they're not going to be like, hey, Nick, you want to direct an episode? Because, I mean, like, would they... I mean, I cannot see any scenario in which they'd be like, I don't know, man. I don't know if he's right for this gig.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. And of course, Zachary, we want to mention the two newest ways to get all of our podcasts, and that is on Google Play Store as well as YouTube. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of Metatrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our Metatrex show page on the Trek FM website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can also find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're on Facebook, find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also invite you to leave a rating and review of Metatrex on iTunes. We would really love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. So, Zachary, when you're not playing Davy Crockett in the holodeck at the Battle of the Alamo, where can our listeners find you on Trek FM and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's dedicated Voyager podcast, along with my co-host there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not busy occupying your thoughts of philosophy and lace, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm occasionally around the Babel Conference on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. You can also find me occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. And if you'd like to read my thoughts on the process of publishing and writing and a little bit about life, check out my blog. It is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank that bastion of good, C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, our art director Aaron Harvey, production manager Richard Marquez, and our Patreon manager Brandon Shea Mutala. We'd also like to give a special shout-out to our associate producers here at Metatrex. They are Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, you can connect with her on Twitter as well. Her Twitter handle is @ChocoWeeble. And Kit Lofstadt, her Twitter handle is @MotherCat. That's Mother with a zero. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.